against Giovanni Gallardo for Milwaukee. Meanwhile, the Cards are placing newly acquired utility man Mark DeRosa on the 15-day disabled list, retroactive to July 1st because of a strained left wrist. The Cardinals also announced infielder Brian Barden and outfielder Nick Stavanoa are being recalled from AAA Memphis. St. Louis is sending infielder Tyler Green to Memphis. DeRosa is a former Cub who was acquired last month from the Cleveland Indians. He was injured during a June 30th game. Meanwhile, Ryan Dempster of the Cubs has been outstanding in his last two starts against Atlanta. He looks to keep things going tonight at Wrigley Field. Javier Vasquez pitches for the Braves. He'll try to cool off Derek Lee, who's been hitting .333 with 5 home runs and 14 RBIs since the first of the month. The White Sox send All-Star Mark Burley to the mound tonight against Cleveland. The White Sox have won 14 of their last 20, including a 3-game sweep of the Indians last week. They're also playing at home tonight. A lawyer for a college athletic conference says it would be in the public's interest if the government investigated the system that determines college football's number one team. Barry Brett represents the Mountain West Conference. He's raising the possibility of antitrust violations in the Bowl Championship Series. He's testifying today before a Senate subcommittee. The Mountain West doesn't get an automatic bid. Utah is in the Mountain West, and it was bypassed for last year's national championship despite going undefeated in the regular season. The title game pitted Florida against Oklahoma, each with one loss. And 2-time judo Olympian Rene Capo has died of lung cancer. He was 48 years old. USA Judo says Capo died yesterday in Chicago. He lived in suburban Naperville. Capo competed at the 1988 and 96 Olympics. Last year, he placed fifth at the USA Judo Senior National Championships. And 2 months after that competition, he was diagnosed with lung cancer. That's a look at sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to explore the newly announced 2009-2010 season. Tickets are on sale Thursday, July 16th at 10 a.m. More information is available online at krannertcenter.com.
It's 2:42. The first case of mad cow disease was discovered in the U.S. nearly 6 years ago. After that, the U.S. Department of Agriculture rolled out a voluntary program to identify animals and farms. Today, only about 1 in 4 cattle has an official ID tag, and the Ag Department says it needs more ranchers and cows to participate to make the program work. From Nebraska, Sarah McCammon of NET Radio reports.
It's a cool, breezy evening on Homer Buell's ranch in the sand hills of north-central Nebraska. Buell, a tall, lean man in his late 50s, guides his pickup truck into a pasture of black Angus cows and calves and points out a small tag on one of the animal's
right
ears.
Here, and you can see it if we look at it from the back. See when she brought her ear up?
Yeah, the little circle?
Yeah,
kind of?
That's an EID.
Buell uses these electronic ID tags for internal record keeping, but the USDA wants more producers to register their livestock facilities and identify their animals with official ID tags. It just wrapped up a series of listening sessions billed as an effort to find out how to get more producers to support the program. But anti-government sentiment runs deep here, and many speakers at the final session near Omaha view animal ID as government intrusion.
No, we do not need animal ID.
Richard Schrunk manages a livestock market in O'Neill, Nebraska. He said producers already know how to keep track of their animals.
No, we may not be able to trace back them cows in 24 hours, but I'll guarantee you in 72 hours we can trace them cows back.
But that could take too long, say veterinarians like Ron DeHaven, who's with the American Veterinary Medical Association. He argues that animal ID should be mandatory in the U.S. as it is in places like Japan and the European Union. Without a full tracking system in place, DeHaven worries about the risk of diseases like the highly contagious foot and mouth virus, which has plagued herds on several continents.
If we were to have an introduction of that kind of disease, we could spread it into 10, 15, or 20 states within the matter of 1 or 2 days.
Mandatory animal ID has some support within the industry, including from groups like the National Pork Producers Council, which advocates federal funding for the program. But many individual producers fear a mandate would harm their industry. Rancher Chris Harvey says she's afraid powerful meatpacking companies could get access to information about ranches in her area and use that to justify paying producers less. Harvey says she and her husband hope someday to pass on their ranch near the South Dakota-Nebraska border to one of their 5 children.
I hate to think that because of a government bureaucracy and a program that is going to take all that away from us, and we will not be able to offer our children that option because it will no longer be profitable to raise cattle. I mean, it's kind of borderline as it is right now.
Harvey says small producers have less bargaining power and would absorb much of the system's costs. For cattle, the USDA estimates the total cost at about $6 per animal, but the price varies widely depending on the number and type of animals produced. Back on the ranch, Homer Buell says he thinks forcing all producers to participate could be impractical.
It's not easy when you have the number of cows we have in the United States that we have in Nebraska to set up an ID system that would work effectively and be tough.
What would be even tougher, animal health officials say, is a disease outbreak without a full tracking system in place. But if the solution requires mandatory animal ID, some producers fear the cure more than the disease. For NPR News, I'm Sarah McCammon in Lincoln, Nebraska.
The U.S. Navy is making some changes, repositioning some of its ships to the West Coast. It's part of the strategic decision to focus more military resources along the Pacific Rim. The Department of Defense is spending billions to support the military buildup. As Allison St. John of member station KPBS reports, investment is turning out to be a boom for San Diego.
Captain Stephen Wershing, head of Naval Facilities Engineering in San Diego, is a busy man. His office awarded nearly $2 billion worth of construction contracts last year to build new facilities for the Navy and Marine Corps in the Southwest region. That's four times more than he gets to spend in a normal year, and he says the building boom has only just begun.
In just the next 2 years, we anticipate doing over $5 billion worth of construction. I would say this is unprecedented, at least in recent history, that we've seen this much money being invested in the infrastructure at the Navy and Marine Corps in this area.
Wershing says most of this money is being spent in San Diego County. New construction is springing up all over the Camp Pendleton Marine Base, and the Navy plans to refurbish and build new barracks for personnel stationed around San Diego Bay. The Navy already homeports 40% of the Pacific Fleet in San Diego, but over the next 5 years, the number of ships based here will increase by about a third, with about 20 more ships expected. One of the early arrivals is the USS Chief. She's a sturdy gray minesweeper. Her captain, John Krishunas, puts his crew through regular drills, operating the remote control submersibles and testing the alarm sirens.
Normally, you don't want to hear those in an underway situation. We're going into a minefield, or we're being attacked, or we're going to conduct an attack. That's collision alarm. When you hear that, something's gone south. So it's not good.
Krishunas says his ship is one of half a dozen minesweepers that have already transferred here from Texas. He says the move saves money and consolidates naval assets into a so-called Center of Excellence for Underwater Warfare in San Diego. The focus is to protect Asian and Persian Gulf coastal waters for U.S. ships.
This is not a big secret. Both Iran has a great contingent of mines, which is in the Middle East, and the Chinese are building up their military, and they have a great contingency of mines, as well as North Korea. So being in Texas kind of put us in a position, well, you're kind of in no man's land in terms of operational and getting deployed. Being out here in San Diego, you're obviously closer to the Pacific side of the house.
DOD spending in San Diego has grown an average of 7% a year over the past few years. In 2008, it's estimated they spent $15 billion in the area. 2009 looks to be well above that. Martin Murphy is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment, an independent policy research institute in Washington, D.C. He says naval assets used to be divided equally between the East and West Coast, but now that's turning into a 60-40 split.
I think it's a long-term change. It's a true rebalancing of U.S. naval assets away from the Atlantic to the Pacific. So in that sense, San Diego is well-positioned.
And it comes at a very opportune time for the San Diego economy. Leisure travel is down, housing construction is flat, and the real estate bubble has burst. San Diego economist Kelly Cunningham.
As the economy has struggled, the military has actually held up, and it's now kind of sustaining the economy because of this continued spending on defense.
But San Diegans know well the boom and bust cycle of defense dollars. The hope is that by the time this boom peters out, the recession will be over and other sectors of the local economy will kick back in. For NPR News, I'm Allison St. John in San Diego.
The food writer Nigella Lawson has this advice for the home cook.
Try something new, which only has one element that frightens you.
Of course, Nigella Lawson is trying new things all the time. Her many cookbooks are evidence of that. She's shared her recipes with NPR listeners many times. And this time, we'll hear what inspired some of her recipes and how one recipe can lead to others, like Nigella's mother's recipe for ham in cider. NPR's Renee Montaigne spoke with Nigella Lawson.
As with so many recipes, even the word recipe is a bit too grand for it because it's just the way she cooked ham. And she used to use cider, which I think you call hard cider. In other words, it's slightly alcoholic, although you could use any cider. And leeks were in there, carrots, parsley stalks. It's just a fantastic way of cooking ham. I mean, that generates so many other recipes of mine. Certainly, I use the broth that it leaves behind for a pea soup. And then I thought, well, you know, if it works with cider, why can't I use other drinks? And although when I first did it, it raised a few eyebrows, I did cook a ham in Coca-Cola. And then I went really mad in one book when I thought, OK, so let's take this a step further. I'm going to do ham in Cherry Coke.
What was that moment when you thought, Cherry Coke, now that would make the difference?
Well, I think it was simply that I so adored, and my children so adored, the ham in Coke, that I must have seen it one day at the market. There is a very long tradition of cooking ham with fruit, ham with pineapple, a great 70s classic. And you cannot tell whether a recipe is going to work or not until you try cooking it. The worst that can happen is that you don't have the best supper of your life, and the best that can happen is that you feel thrilled and excited and gratified by the fact that it's worked.
You have said that time pressure often influences you when you're coming up with a recipe, with the kids and obviously with a busy life. Your linguine with lemon would seem to be an example of that.
It's a very good example of that. And it also shows how recipes come about, because you can often be inspired by a recipe that you don't actually copy, but that you draw from. So, for example, there was an Anna Del Conte recipe for a lemon risotto. And I thought, well, if that sort of rich lemoniness, because with the cheese in it as well and the lemon, if it works with rice, surely it's going to work with pasta. And therefore you can really prepare everything, have a pan of water ready boiling, mix your sauce, which is really just egg yolks and a bit of heavy cream and some lemon zest and juice and some parmesan. And then when you want to cook, you're just ready to go. It's just sticking the pasta in the pot, and then once it's drained, adding the sauce you've made. As I say, you don't cook the sauce. So it's very, very easy, both in sort of energy and time.
Is that how it works? You just know one flavor and one texture and feel like, just move it over a little bit to something else?
It's a bit like that. But obviously, what ends up in the book is probably not my first attempt. The first time I might make it too rich and the lemon may be not pervasive enough. And the next time I do it, I've overcompensated and it's too sharp. And what I always feel like saying, of course, is that what's the perfect balance for me may not be the perfect balance for the person using the recipe. In the end, this isn't about some great chemical formula. It's about taste. Now, baking's a different matter. That, you know, as I often say, is a mixture between poetry and chemistry. But cooking is, you just have to feel your way as you go, like child rearing.
Although it is like a little bit of a you can do it at home chemistry recipe. You're playing around with it, but you have to have some sense of what works with what.
Well, you do have to have some sense, but you don't get that sense just because you're born with it. You have to try things out. And I think one of the things that stops people being confident is that they have this curious, I would say, sort of a life of two sides. When one side is not cooking and the other is, suddenly I'll have eight people for supper. You're going, as it were, from naught to 120 miles an hour, and you can't do that. So I really do feel that the best way of finding out what works and what you like and what you don't like is by experimenting when you're cooking just for yourself. And then you feel more confident. You're not fearing someone else's judgment. And that gives you much more freedom, I think.
It might also help to start with a recipe that, you know, you've made over and over again and you love it, but know exactly what's going on there.
Exactly. And you want to tweak a little. And I think that just as in when scientists do experiments, they don't change everything all at once, or they can't tell which changes have been beneficial or which have been influenced the outcome. So if you regularly do a beef stew with rosemary, well, it may be worth thinking, let's try it now with some lamb and some thyme. And then later on you can think, well, although I liked it with red wine, why don't I make this a bit lighter and use some rosé wine?
Can you tell us of one of these experiments or sort of progressions in thinking from one recipe to an experimental one that was a flop?
There's one thing that is irredeemable, and that's oversalting. I don't care what people say. Once you've oversalted, you've had it.
You can't put a raw potato in.
You can do all that, but it's not going to make it taste any better. It'll just make you feel you've put up a good fight.
Nigella Lawson is the author of a whole bunch of cookbooks, and most recently, Nigella Express. Well, thanks for joining us again.
It's always a pleasure.
And you can get some today's pleasure from Nigella's recipes for lemon and linguine and ham in cider. You'll find them at our website, npr.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Earth and Sky.
That's time now to act and find ways to provide the world with energy while mitigating the negative consequences of CO2 on the temperature of the planet.
You're listening to Jan van der Eyck, Chief Technology Officer for Shell. Dr. van der Eyck spoke of an independent report from 2007 indicating that existing and emerging technologies could, by the year 2030, reduce global atmospheric CO2 by 25% of today's levels.
Now, we are having a whole spectrum of projects. Our biggest in-house effort, so to say, is to make sure that we ourselves produce as low an amount of CO2 as possible.
In other words, making oil refineries more energy efficient, said van der Eyck. He also spoke of carbon capture and storage, where CO2 emissions are gathered at the surface and permanently stored underground. Oil refineries and other industries could lower their emissions as the storage of CO2 underground is tested and advanced.
In general, we feel that we would like these projects to move forward more aggressively than they're doing today, and it very much has to do with the need to build up frameworks, legal frameworks, but also societal acceptance of the testing.
More about energy at our website. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
MRI technology allows doctors to see specific brain activity, but some researchers say it's easy to misinterpret brain signals.
It's like listening to a radio station in which there's a lot of static. So sometimes the noise will sort of obscure being able to hear the people or even being able to pick up the station at all.
Misleading